President Biden tells Congress that Israel will get more aid.
The president is very clear that he's going to continue to provide Israel with all of the capabilities it needs to defend itself against Hamas. But the president does not want certain categories of American weapons used in particular type of operation.
Plus, the Secretary of State is still in Kyiv.
Antony Blinken and Dmytro Kuleba, Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs, they also had pizza in one of the Kyiv restaurants.
And later, aid trucks bound for Gaza are looted, and a look at the Iranian nuclear program as a wider conflict in the Middle East might be on the horizon. Today is Wednesday, May 15th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Starting off with some breaking news out of Europe, Robert Fico, the Slovakian prime minister, was shot multiple times in an apparent assassination attempt on Wednesday. This according to a Slovak Interior Ministry spokesperson. The populist pro-Russian leader was shot in the stomach. His wounds are said to be life-threatening, though there are no details yet on his condition. A suspect is in custody, however, there is no word on his motives or identity. The Slovakian president, Zuzana Čaputová, condemned the attack as brutal and reckless. For more on this story as it develops, visit us online at voanews.com. On Tuesday, the Israeli army released drone footage showing armed men standing next to UN-marked vehicles at a UN compound in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, and has called on the UN to investigate. An IDF statement said troops had identified fighters inside the central logistics compound of the UN Palestinian Relief Agency, or UNRWA, east of Rafah. An UNRWA spokesperson said the agency is examining the footage and would share information once it becomes available. Meanwhile, aid trucks bound for Gaza have been looted and destroyed. Christy Kilburn of Reuters has more.
Palestinian hauliers said on Tuesday they feared for the security of aid convoys to Gaza a day after Israeli protesters wrecked the trucks. Videos circulating on social media on Monday showed protesters throwing supplies from the trucks at the Tarkamia checkpoint. The head of the Hebron Food Trade Association said Israeli soldiers stood by as the attack took place. Adel Imar is from the West Bank-based Hauliers Union.
We went to the checkpoint, and after the checks, we were surprised to see settlers on the roundabout of the checkpoint. They damaged the cars, they tore the tires off the trucks, they threw the contents of the trucks on the ground. We gathered some of the products and sent some of those products onto a bulldozer and sent them to sheep farms. Around 15 trucks were damaged, their hull was damaged, windows of trucks were broken, some drivers were beaten, some of the products were thrown away, and the whole loss for Hebron is around $2 million.
Amar said some drivers are now refusing to take goods to Gaza because they are afraid. A group calling itself Order 9 has claimed Monday's attack and says it acted to stop supplies reaching Hamas, accusing the Israeli government of giving gifts to the Islamist group. Palestinians and human rights groups have accused the Israeli military and police of deliberately failing to intervene when settlers attack Palestinians in the West Bank. The violent protests drew condemnation from the U.S., which has urged Israel to step up deliveries of aid into Gaza. Britain's foreign minister also condemned the, quote, appalling incident, saying Israel must call the attackers to account. No comment was available from the Israeli military. The Israeli police said a number of people were arrested and the incident was being investigated.
That's Christy Kilburn of Reuters reporting for us today. President Joe Biden is advancing over $1 billion in military assistance to Israel, even as Israel prepares to enter Rafah, which the U.S. has said it would not support, and even after the U.S. has halted shipments of some bombs last week for fear they could harm civilians. For a look at this seemingly contradictory stance, I'm joined by White House Bureau Chief Patsy Weedakuswara.
As of Wednesday this morning, White House has not actually confirmed the amount, but they have signaled that, as you said, other than the shipment of those 35,000 large-sized bombs that was paused earlier this month because they don't want Israel to drop them in densely populated cities, the arms transfers are receiving as scheduled. And they don't see this as mixed messaging. They say that the president is very clear that he's going to continue to provide Israel with all of the capabilities it needs to defend itself against Hamas. But the president does not want certain categories of American weapons used in particular type of operation, particularly in Rafah. So even though they're warning Israel not to move forward with the full ground assault at Rafah, they want to ensure that Israel receives all the money, all the full amount provided in the supplemental the $26 billion package. However, we do not know whether this last transfer of $1 billion reportedly is part of the $26 billion package or from existing previous packages.
It'd be naive not to talk about American domestic politics when we talk about giving aid to Israel, certainly now. The Republicans are having a field day attacking Biden for withholding the weapons last week. Is this a political response to what's going on, or is this responding to Israel's needs on the ground?
Well, we don't know for sure, obviously, because we can't get into the president's head, but certainly politics is part of the calculation, as well as President Biden's own conviction, own belief that he wants to support Israel in its efforts against Hamas. The president is receiving pressure from both sides, all sides, not just the Republicans who want to move forward with all the weapons. I mean, they're even planning on a bill to mandate the delivery of offensive weapons for Israel that the White House has already said the President Biden will veto if it passed Congress. But they're also getting a lot of pressure from the progressive wings of the Democratic Party. You know that all these student protests all over campuses in the U.S., for example, is a big show of the displeasure that Arab and Muslim Americans, as well as young voters and progressives, feel about the president's support for Israel.
Now, what do we know about a timeline for this new round of aid that's being discussed? Is this something that's going to happen immediately?
So we don't know about the timeline of this particular weapons transfer, but I would say that overall, all weapons transfers to Israel that have occurred since October 7th is a very murky process. If you would recall, in December, Secretary of State Antony Blinken approved two emergency weapons transfers to Israel bypassing congressional review requirements. And then since then, there have been two additional transfers that have been made public and notified to Congress. But on top of these four transfers that we know of, since October 7th, more than 100 arms transfers to Israel have taken place without informing Congress. And that's mainly because the packages were structured to fall below the notification threshold. So under U.S. law, the administration must notify Congress of weapons transfers to Israel that are worth more than $25 million. But what the administration has done, which a lot of human rights activists are criticizing, is basically breaking up these arms transfers into smaller packages so that they can get around the requirement to notify Congress.
And do we think that's why they're doing it? Or is it just a coincidence that the weapons they're sending to meet the needs happen to be below that threshold?
Well, we don't know for sure what the motivations are, but definitely this is something that is unusual. I mean, if you think about it, breaking up a contract into smaller contracts create a lot of work for both the Department of State and the Defense Department. So, you know, cynically, some human rights activists have said that this is an effort by the Biden administration to deliberately be non-transparent about the process. But since then, especially with the fact that now $26 billion have been approved in this latest supplemental package, we expect that there will be a lot more scrutiny on the process and the administration will have to give answers.
And as there is more scrutiny, Patsy, we'll definitely be calling you back. Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Patsy, thanks for your reporting today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Kyiv. He's there to meet with Ukrainian leadership to discuss defense and security. More on that in a moment. But he was also asked about the situation in Gaza at a press conference midday on Wednesday.
With regard to Gaza, one of the deep concerns that we have is the impact of this limited operation that we've seen to date in Rafah on the ability to provide humanitarian assistance, because the two main points of access in the south, Rafah itself and Kerem Shalom, have been affected by the resulting conflict in the south. And we've seen at the very time when Israel was taking important and much-needed steps to improve the provision of humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in Gaza, we've seen a negative impact on the fact that we have this very active conflict in the Rafah area.
Along with humanitarian aid, the Secretary of State commented on the U.S.'s view for a post-war Gaza.
We've been very clear that when it comes to the future of Gaza, we do not support and will not support an Israeli reoccupation. We also, of course, do not support Hamas governance in Gaza. We know and have seen where that's led all too many times for the people of Gaza and for Israel. And we also can't have anarchy and a vacuum that's likely to be filled by chaos. That only underscores the imperative of having a clear, concrete plan for the day after the conflict in Gaza, in terms of governance, in terms of security, in terms of rebuilding Gaza for its people.
Well, as I mentioned, Antony Blinken has been in Kyiv, where he met with President Volodymyr Zelensky on Tuesday to discuss aid and security. Tuesday evening, Blinken ate pizza in Kyiv with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, and then later Tuesday night, the Secretary of State played guitar on stage with a rock band in a Kyiv bar. On Wednesday, he was back at work and addressed the press with Kuleba. For a look at the latest, I'm joined by VOA's Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova.
With President Zelensky, there were two main topics discussed. First of all, of course, the front line, the situation in the Kharkiv region, where Russian forces are trying to advance and break through the Ukrainian defense line. Another topic, important topic, was about the upcoming peace summit, which is going to happen in Switzerland next month. And President Zelensky said to Antony Blinken that Ukraine, that for Ukraine, it is extremely important that President Biden is in attendance. This will be a very strong message for all the partners and for everyone who will be following this summit.
And of course, following his meeting with Zelensky, Blinken met with Dmytro Kuleba, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And I would imagine many of the same topics were discussed, no?
Well, yes, but I think that with Minister of Foreign Affairs, Antony Blinken had also additional discussions about more long-term things. They were discussing this agreement, which is on the final stages, as was announced, the bilateral agreement, defense agreement between Ukraine and U.S. Also, what was discussed is that considering that U.S. is facing elections, this bilateral agreement is to be in action with the current administration. And there were a lot of questions around if the next administration will also follow this agreement. And was announced that, it should be in action even if administration changes and when administration changes. Also important question, and I think it was one of the most asked question from journalists, from our colleagues, and from Ukrainian also society, is if U.S. will still deny Ukraine using U.S. weapon on the territory of Russia, because as we can see now, Russia is attacking on the in the border area, and a lot of experts also believe that if Ukraine had a chance to use U.S. Military aid and weapon on the territory of Russia, this assault could have been stopped faster and could have been even prevented. And Blinken said that basically he did not really answer this question directly, but he said that Ukraine will have all the means to use in order to win this war, and the U.S. will make sure that Ukraine has all these means, and this will be for Ukraine to decide how to use them. So,
now, Anna, my last question for you. I think the video has made its way around the world by now. Certainly one of the most interesting things to have seen on a Secretary of State's visit anywhere in the world. Antony Blinken was playing the guitar in a rock and roll band in an underground bar in Kyiv last night. How did that come to happen?
Yeah, you're right. That was a surprise event, actually. No one expected that. And I should say that before that performance, Antony Blinken and Dmytro Kuleba, Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs, they also had pizza in one of the Kyiv restaurants. And in terms of the guitar performance, there are different opinions on that. So some people are saying that, this is demonstration of support of Ukraine at war. So Antony Blinken demonstrated that despite the war, Ukrainian life is ongoing and people are trying, to live the life, basically, despite the war. Some people say that this was not really appropriate and that it was a little weird seeing Antony Blinken and guitar performance. This is what happened, and definitely this was something no one expected and something not very common in terms of diplomatic language,
Not common indeed. Anna, we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Conflict has forced a record number of people around the world to become internally displaced, forced to flee their homes, but still living in their home countries, often in refugee camps. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the figure has increased dramatically in the past 5 years.
In recent months, thousands of people have arrived at the Bulengo camp for internally displaced people near Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. They have fled fighting between the Congolese army and M23 rebel groups. Faida Bauma arrived with her 4 children. Look at the conditions in which we live, Bauma says. When it rains here, we suffer. Look at where we sleep. When it rains, we have to fold our mattresses. We are going to die here, she says. People are even raped. Conflict and violence have driven the number of internally displaced people around the world to a new record, according to a new report from the Geneva-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. Almost half live in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 76 million people globally were forced to flee their homes in 2023 and are living elsewhere in their own countries, many in camps or makeshift accommodation. That's an increase of almost 50% over the past 5 years. Ivana Hajmanova is a co-author of the report.
Half of this figure comes from just 5 countries, including Sudan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Colombia, Yemen, and Syria. And these countries are usually not visible in the media headlines.
Sudan has the largest internally displaced population in the world at more than 9 million people. Most were forced to flee their homes after the latest civil conflict erupted in April 2023. Again, Ivana Hajmanova.
Many of them have been forced to move multiple times. So we saw families moving away from Khartoum, going to the Darfur regions, moving all across the country. And of course, we are very concerned about their needs and their vulnerabilities, because with each new displacement, their resilience reduces.
Some 4 out of every 5 Palestinians have been forced to flee their homes in the Gaza Strip because of the conflict between Israel and Hamas, according to the report's authors. With borders closed, most have nowhere safe to go. Ivana Hajmanova.
Recent UN estimates point out to the fact that it will take around 80 years to rebuild everything which had been destroyed in the Gaza Strip. And this shows that it might be that most of the people who are currently living in Gaza and who have been displaced won't see their houses rebuilt during their lifetime.
Close to 8 million internally displaced people were forced to flee because of natural disasters. The February 2023 earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria triggered 4.7 million displacements. Cyclone Freddy, which hit southern Africa in February and March last year, forced 1.4 million people to become displaced. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Back now to the Middle East, the head of the UN nuclear agency, Rafael Grossi, has criticized recent comments by Iranian officials who suggest Tehran may be forced into developing nuclear weapons. Kamal Kharizi, an advisor to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, told a domestic conference this week that Iran would have to change its doctrine of not seeking nuclear weapons if faced with threats from nuclear-armed countries. The next opportunity for Western powers to press Iran to stop uranium enrichment will come in an IAEA meeting next month. My colleague Michael Lippin met with Behnam Bentaleblou. He's a senior Iran analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and asked him why Taleblou thinks Iran has the upper hand in its nuclear standoff with the West.
I think without a shadow of a doubt, we know now, given the Atomic Archive, given how advanced Iran's nuclear program now is, that it's more a political decision in Iran not to go for a weapons option at this moment. And certainly there has been a lot of pulled punches, unfortunately, from the Biden administration in trying to engage in this constrain-restrain strategy.
The Iranian side in the past has denied wanting nuclear weapons, but you have more and more officials in recent weeks and months hinting and saying even more explicitly that we might need to develop nuclear weapons in the future to deal with threats. There was a senior advisor to the Supreme Leader, Khamenei, making such a statement just within the last couple of days. So what does this signal about Iran's direction?
I fear we're going to hear more and more and more of this kind of commentary. Really, there's a string of such commentary by political officials, military officials, even nuclear officials in Iran for the past few years, talking about being pushed into the idea of having a nuclear weapon. You know, they're essentially, what they're doing is dangling their robust, allegedly civilian nuclear infrastructure as a sort of Damocles over Israel, over America, over the UN, over the international community, saying that if significant action to constrain or restrain Iran's nuclear ambitions happens, that that would actually force Iran to move towards, you know, more overtly pursuing a weapon. And this is essentially, you know, nuclear blackmail 101. It's one of the reasons why, you know, the JCPOA should not have happened. It's one of the reasons why you should have not had domestic enrichment in Iran to begin with. It's one of the reasons why you don't want to bless such a robust nuclear program when it is not in compliance with its safeguards agreements and when there are still more questions than answered about Iran's allegedly past weaponization activities. So we were always going to get to this point. It's like someone running to the ledge of a cliff and then saying, hey, you pushed me.
Well, how serious do you think is Iran's threat to nuclearize if they get pushed?
I think there's a real debate over what the if they get pushed looks like. But putting that aside for one second, there's a thesis me and some others have. We've kind of all arrived at it simultaneously, which is that in some weird way, Iran is already getting a lot of the benefits of a nuclear weapon. Look, there's been no overt American or Israeli attack in the past two decades, despite a lot of the things that would have warranted limited or larger amounts of military force against the Islamic Republic or against its interests. So this is one weird position that the Islamic Republic has found itself in, that going all the way may be more trouble. Conversely, no state pays all of these costs without going all the way. So unfortunately, it seems to be more a question of when, not if, the Islamic Republic may go there. And they may go there at a time of their own choosing, when they feel Israel or America or the international community is paying attention to other issues. You know, there's no shortage of hotspots right now, Gaza, Ukraine, God forbid, potentially Taiwan. And this is, again, the problem of having such a robust nuclear program on this kind of territory, that it can more easily be weaponized at a time of their choosing.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Behnam Bentaleblou from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And that's going to end today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.